Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. For almost 30 years, the graphic novelist Adrian Tomine has created some of the most beautiful graphic artwork you will ever see, including his covers for The New Yorker. In 2021, Adrian joined us to talk about his graphic memoir, The Loneliness of the Long-Distance Cartoonist. As best-selling, award-winning author Zadie Smith has written about his work, Adrian Tomine can draw, think, write, and feel. He sees everything. He knows everything. He's in your apartment. He's on the subway. He's in your dreams. He has more ideas in 20 panels than novelists have in a lifetime. Adrian's latest book is Q&A. As the title indicates, he's answering the many questions his devoted fans have asked him about his work and methods over the years.
The book came about as a result of the evolving nature of my profession, which is that I started out publishing my work in comic book format, like a serialized publication, and that sort of opened up a very lively line of communication with the readership. I published an address, a P.O. box, and people would write to me there, and I would print letters in the comic, and I would respond to them directly sometimes. And then as the nature of publishing comics in North America evolved and moved more towards this graphic novel book format, that was one of the casualties of it, the letters column from comic books, at least the kind of work that I do, it sort of disappeared. And I was sort of missing that and realizing what profound impact that relationship I had with an audience had on me as a person and as an artist and on the work. And so that was sort of the germ of the idea of how to structure a book that would be nonfiction, personal essays, advice about the craft of being a cartoonist and a screenwriter and an illustrator, but to also make sure that I focused on things that people cared about, not just what interested me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You have said that some of the correspondence you receive from people is occasionally uncomfortable and sometimes genuinely confounding. How so?
A lot of that reached its apex in the pre-social media era, back when the volume of mail that I got was kind of hard to imagine in this day and age. And it would really run the gamut from fan mail to very angry, critical mail to strange packages with stuff in it. It was really all over the map. And a lot of that kind of evaporated once people started communicating more through direct messages on social media.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about your tools of the trade, specifically pens. What kind of pens do you use for sketches and for inking?
It's a very frequently asked question. And what I always say is that I'm happy to answer it. And in the book, I'm happy to even show photos and go into detail about the tools that I use. But I hope no one takes it as this right answer, as these are the tools that are the best. For me, it was a long process to sort of break myself of that sense that what other artists use was the right way and that everything else was wrong. And I think it's very important for people to find what works best for them. Having said that, the tools that I use most now that I describe in the book are a dip pen from Japan made by a company called Tachikawa. And that's a very old-fashioned kind of pen. It's for anyone younger than me, they'd probably be surprised to see that it's something that you insert into a wooden handle and that you dip into a bottle of ink. For little details and for sketching and things, I have evolved to the point where I'm using markers. They're called pit markers of different widths, which were sort of maybe looked down on a little bit when I was developing as a cartoonist. You're supposed to use rapidographs that you refill with India ink and you maintain very fastidiously. So that was sort of an evolution. And I also use a brush a lot, which again is sort of hard to comprehend for people who've grown up in the digital age, but I do use a sable hair brush. It's actually made for watercolor, but I use it for inking. And if you look at like the covers that I do for The New Yorker, most of that is drawn with a brush.
Mm. You have said that you would like to make a brief pitch on behalf of cheap tools. And so I think now's as good a time as any for you to make that brief pitch, which will be more of a pitchette, I guess we could say,
yeah,
right now, if you would
sure,
like to.
Sure, just that as a self-taught artist who sort of learned by scrounging around trying to find any written information that an artist might have given in an interview or in a book. I just became very obsessive about using the right tools, about kind of a perfectionistic element that came into my work as a result of using these tools, a lot of which are very expensive. I'm talking about paper that costs $10 per sheet and ink that I had to order from some warehouse and these brushes that are made from sable hair and all these things. And I found that it was having sort of a constricting effect on me as an artist. And so when I finished my book, Shortcomings, just as the ultimate experiment, I said, I'm going to go to the 24-hour pharmacy here in Brooklyn. And the next story I do, I'm going to make only with things that I can buy right now at this pharmacy. And I came out with a pack of printer paper and a mechanical pencil and a felt tip pen. And it felt absolutely insane to me that I was going to try this. But I sat down and I did it. And it's hard for me to rate my work. But the story that I did with those materials is called Killing and Dying. The response was really good. Certainly no one said, you use cheap tools on this story, you know. But more importantly to me, I felt freed up to focus on the content and the emotional aspects of the story rather than the surface of the paper that I was using or the refilling of the ink on the pen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. When you were finishing up the final chapter of your book, Shortcomings, you became preoccupied with making each page perfect. Why?
It was just what I was talking about. I was really in the grip of perfectionism, OCD, whatever you want to call it. And in a lot of ways, that wasn't productive to the work. Maybe five people in the world would see the original pages that I was drawing on, but thousands of people were going to be reading it in its printed form, and that should have been more of the priority. You know, it was something that I've had to fight against just in my life in general, especially as a parent too. It's this need for perfection and cleanliness and precision, all those things that can be helpful in some ways, but can also be very detrimental.
I'm sorry you have to deal with that, OCD especially. That's something that is an issue for me as well. So I think I know I have kind of a sense of what you're going through with that.
Yeah.
After you spent almost 5 years writing Shortcomings, you wanted to find a new way of making comics.
Right.
Why? Was it because of this perfection thing, or there must have been an entirely different reason, or maybe not?
It's all of the above. I mean, I feel like each book I do is in some ways a reaction to the previous book, trying to do something differently. The mode that I was working on with Shortcomings is extremely precise, very realistic, very detailed. And so a lot of the rules that I'd imposed on myself for Shortcomings, not just the drawing style, but like needing to set all the scenes in real locations and being very precise about costume design and things like that, I just wanted to try and free myself of a little bit and try and allow different influences. It's, again, hard to describe now in the sense that kind of a cultural revolution in North America has happened in terms of how comics are perceived and respected. But at the start of my career, I really was working with a chip on my shoulder and trying to prove very badly to the world that what I was doing was different from superhero comics or newspaper comic strips, and that I was alternative, quote unquote. And as time went on, I felt like that rebellious stance was only doing harm to my work, not proving anything to anyone else. And so after Shortcomings, I was really interested in moving away from that and opening myself up to a lot of the elements of cartooning that I thought looked too childish or mainstream or whatever it might be.
To a large extent, it sounds like your inner critic is pretty loud.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's hard. It's hard.
Yeah. You adapted Shortcomings into a screenplay for the major motion picture of the same name. What was that experience like?
That was surprising. I think that's the main word, is that every aspect of it was surprising. And most surprising was how much I enjoyed it. I kind of went in to the process with a sense of skepticism, almost hoping that it would go so badly that it would confirm the way I had lived and worked for the previous 30 years, which is sitting at a desk working alone in a bedroom. And to my great surprise, I really enjoyed the writing process. Working on the screenplay was really fun and invigorating to me. And then the whole process beyond that, the production and post-production and the promotion. And even when there were aspects of it that were frustrating or infuriating or not going the way I wanted, I still had this strange sense of gratitude to be having those experiences because I'd grown up such an obsessive movie fan. And, you know, I've always been interested in behind the scenes things and reading books and watching movies about the making of things. And so to really be a part of that process, every little element of it, no matter how insignificant to the greater project, I felt like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going and getting gummy bears from a craft services truck or something like that. it was very exciting for me. And I really loved the people that I got to work with and just enjoyed every minute of getting to know them.
That's great to hear. And it's also great, belated congratulations to you on the film version of Shortcomings. It debuted at Sundance and received great reviews. And I get the sense you weren't really expecting that, were you?
Well, I never expect anything positive. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. You got to turn down the inner critic.
Going to the premiere at Sundance was definitely one of the high points of my career and probably my life. And I love going on Letterboxd and reading the reviews from people. You know, there's critic reviews are interesting, but also to hear directly from people who've seen the movie is entertaining and, again, very educational to me.
That's great to hear. You describe your wife, Sarah, as your most candid, consistent editor and critic for the past 20 years. How has Sarah helped you shape your work?
I think I mentioned this in the book, that when we first started dating, she wasn't familiar with my work. She hadn't read anything. And at a certain point, she did. She found some copies of my books and read them. And when she closed the cover, she said, oh, I liked it. It's just that in real life, you're so funny. And first, I took it as a great compliment because I was like, oh, okay, in real life, I've made her laugh. And that's that's great. Then it sort of filtered down through my brain a few minutes, and I realized, oh, that's a devastating criticism of the work itself, that it's so serious and devoid of humor. You know, I think that was the start of a process of me trying to integrate more of my real personality and interests into the work. And like I described previously, to sort of free myself of this self-serious need to define myself in contrast to other types of comic books.
You're probably best known for your beautiful cover illustrations for The New Yorker. Can you kind of take us through a brisk walk on how you go about doing that?
Sure, yeah. It's a very streamlined process because I've been doing it so long with the same very small group of people, probably almost 20 years now. And it's sort of like when an idea strikes me, I sketch it out very roughly. I've learned not to turn in a final piece of artwork and not even to work very hard on the sketch, but to just get the very essence of the idea down on paper quickly. And I send that in to the arts editor there named Francoise Mouly, who I credit 100% with me having my artwork on the cover of the magazine. And she has always been very helpful with finessing the idea, clarifying it, improving it. And then I'm sort of left on my own to create the artwork and turn it in. Really, it's incredible that the deadline is on Thursday evening, that I'll work all the way up to the very last minute on Thursday. By Monday, it's everywhere. And I go out and take the subway and I look at people holding it. And yeah, it's a great experience.
Quick question for you, Adrian. If I'm not mistaken, you are the proud owner of a Technivore Mocha Master coffee brewer.
Now, how did you know that?
I knew that because, well, I guess, but it seemed because your art is so good. And there was a piece in the Q&A. There was a piece where you're cleaning up in the kitchen. And I go, hey, that looks like a Technivore Mocha Master.
Yes, you are correct. And this is not the first time something like this has happened. There's been other very sharp readers of my work who figured out the brand of the rice cooker that I even have because it's appeared in the background of some illustrations.
Very cool.
And I'm not getting paid to say this, but it is a great coffee machine.
Yeah. Adrian Tomine, thank you very much. Was that close enough?
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Do it again.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Coach. Adrian Tomine, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Q&A. I loved reading it, and I look forward to admiring more of your work as soon as possible, but no pressure.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you again.
Graphic novelist and illustrator Adrian Tomine is the author of Q&A. Find out more about Adrian and his work at wpr.org/beta.
James Brown's music was, for African Americans, proof that Africa really was over there.
Coming up, music producer and author Joe Boyd joins us to talk about his book, And the Roots of Rhythm Remain, A Journey Through Global Music. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.